had to go about it, write it out and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you. I had to fail, had to fall, just for what I did well. And there's some stories I can tell you.
Welcome to The Final Word, the Guardian Ashes podcast. We are coming to you from the Gabba Cricket Ground not long after Australia has gone 1-0 up in the Ashes with a 10-wicket win. My name is Jeff Lemon. Adam Collins is alongside me. And we probably weren't due to record for another couple of days, but we just had to get something down right now. We got the mixing bowl out. We whipped up the waffle mix. We're pouring it into the pan. And we're going to bring you some hot, fresh takes straight off the griddle.
Yeah, I think that's right, Jeff. We spoke about this morning and we said, I think we kind of have to. After the front page stories this morning about Johnny Bairstow and Cameron Bancroft, I think we probably would have left it alone, not even talked about it, if not for the incredibly amusing postscript we saw after play today. So, of course, we're going to great depth about what was a pretty pulsating test match for at least 3 days anyway before Australia waltzed home by 10 wickets. But the presser today with Cameron Bancroft, what a debut, makes 82 not out on the field, comes out and puts on an absolute clinic of how you manage the media thereafter. It was as funny and as an open, as a forthright, as a media appearance as I've seen. Make sure you grab yourself a listen to the audio or the video somewhere on YouTube at some stage or another. He was absolutely brilliant, and he found a way to not only to diffuse the issue and make sure that it wouldn't be an issue for him, but probably took some pressure off England as well.
Yeah, it was a strange kind of story. It started burbling around late yesterday that there was some rumour that at some point a few weeks ago in Perth, England wicketkeeper Johnny Bairstow had headbutted Cameron Bancroft in a bar. Now, immediately people got sort of quite flustered about this, violence, drunkenness, so on and so on.
And it's the stuff that newspapers dream of as well, by the way. I mean, you add those component parts together, there's the comparisons to David Warner a couple of years ago. I mean, it had all the conditions, all the elements for a perfect Ashes beat-up.
So they picked up in the stump mic David Warner saying, "Are you going to headbutt another one of our players?" while he was batting. Now, immediately people then think, if you say another one of our players, that implies you have previously headbutted a player. They start digging into that story. They find out that it may be true. They get through today, and at the end of today, after the match is lost, England pops up Johnny Bairstow at the press conference, and they say he's not going to take any questions, but he is going to make a statement. And he made quite a jolly sort of statement, really. He said, we were out having a bit of fun, and, things sometimes get a bit silly, and there was no malice involved, and it's all fine, and everyone's happy, and I'll be off, see you later. And then everyone said, yeah, but what actually happened?
Yeah, well, I kind of thought when he started that, he was as much communicating to the English press about the fact that he wasn't drinking that heavily. That's been a theme of the build-up for the England side. Will they have a curfew? Will they have a booze ban? All these sorts of things. And Trevor Bayliss, the England coach, who put his head up after Bairstow, took questions, and Joe Root fronted the press as well, one after another. It was all very organised and very methodical, and I think it worked quite well. But by the time Bancroft got up, we still weren't entirely sure what had happened, and then he takes over and gives the most masterful display.
Well, this was the weird thing, right, is that both the coach and the captain said, I think Johnny's made it perfectly clear what happened. And then we all said, well, actually, Johnny hasn't made it perfectly clear what happened because he didn't actually say what happened.
Yeah, so Trevor Bayliss had to answer that question, and he made something to the effect of the heads made contact, but it didn't constitute a headbutt. So you get into these you're into the weeds pretty quickly when you're down on that. But I mean, we should actually relay. I might read from what Cameron Bancroft said. I typed it out at the time, and there was some absolutely cracking lines in here. He goes on and talks about they won a Sheffield Shield game for Western Australia, and one of our values is celebrating success. That coincided when the England team were arriving for their tour game. It was very friendly, mingling the whole night. As the night progressed, it was great to meet some of those guys. I got into a very amiable conversation with Johnny, and he greeted me with a headbutt kind of thing. I was expecting a handshake. It was not the greeting choice I was expecting, but that's the way I took it. There was certainly no malice in his action. We went on to have a very good conversation for the rest of the evening. I mean, that's just the start of it. I mean, you can take it up. We had a jolly good time. He greeted me with a headbutt, and then we just pushed on and sunk a few pints or whatever it was. The premise is what got us going to begin with.
Yeah, the premise is, look, it was marginally strange, and I did take note of the fact that this wasn't the usual process of greeting a person to which I was accustomed. However, I immediately put that aside and continued to get on the lash with the same guy for the next few hours.
Yeah, well, there's another that you guys hear. For me personally, it was just very weird. It was just so random. I didn't expect it coming. A handshake or a hug would have been something I probably would have expected more than a headbutt. And then the next bit, which is definitely my favourite bit. He didn't knock me over. I have the heaviest head in the West Australian squad. There's an actual measurement. It was a good hit. Play on. And by this point, I should add, Steve Smith sitting next to him was in absolute hysterics. He was having the time of his life. No questions to the captain. It was just straight on Bancroft. And as I said before, it was a great debut on the field and an equally impressive one off it.
I just love the fact that there is an actual measurement of who has the heaviest head.
You can do this. I've done this. I've been involved in trying to measure the biggest head in the ACT. We used to open it up each year to have who had the biggest head in Canberra, and I was the referee, so we used to dunk people's heads into a bucket, and the amount of water displaced would dictate who had the largest head. I don't know how they did it, but I've got recommendations for if they want to have another crack next year. Maybe Mitchell Marsh wants to get in the mixer and say he's got a massive head, Mitchell. Actually, we're bearing the lead here. How did Mitchell Marsh not win the biggest head in West Australia? I've never seen a bloke with a bigger scone than Mitchell.
He's kind of got a narrow head, though, Mitchell. Marsh, he's got one of those hatchet heads, you know, where he can, if the doors only open a crack, he could get at least half of his head through it and have a look around and then quietly withdraw and go about his day if he doesn't like the look of what's inside.
Maybe they could let the veterans to play as well. I reckon Joe Angel would have a massive head on him as well. Am I missing someone here? You're looking at me bewildered.
Blocker Wilson.
He played for WA briefly. I think we're onto something here.
Although I think we may be being distracted at this point because that's about the size of the head, the water displacement. It's not about the weight of the head.
Surely one follows the next. Surely you don't have a denser head than the next person.
Well, maybe some people are airheads. And yeah. Some people are blockheads.
And some have massive brains.
But I don't know how they weigh the head as separate to the rest of the body, because in order to weigh the head, you have to take it off the body.
This reminds me of that David Brent passage when there's more sugar in a lemon than there is in a strawberry, or whatever it is. It's sort of like we're fairly deep in the weeds. But
to come back to what I think is the most amazing line in this whole thing, I just took it as, I don't know Johnny Bairstow, but he says hello very differently to most others. Is that not the most charming way of looking at a situation that you could possibly be put off by, but you choose to take this sort of kind, encompassing, welcoming view?
He knew what he was doing. I'm going to go behind the fourth wall a bit here. Our colleague, Will McPherson, who writes prolifically for The Guardian, amongst others, spoke to Bancroft briefly at the end of the press conference. He said to him, "Gee, you're pretty funny." And Bancroft goes, "I know I am." I think by like feeding the beast, he's made sure that this will now be something in the rear vision mirror for this series rather than something that takes it over, which is, I think that's really important, because and we'll segue into the test match now, because for the first few days, it did really look like we had a humdinger on our hands. We haven't had a competitive series in this country, we mentioned last week, for 35 years, and it looks like we had the preconditions for a fantastic, an epic almost first test, given how slow the scoring rate was and how hard the wickets were to come by on the first day. Everything looked more or less in play for, you know, the sort of the grandstand finish. And I'm disappointed we didn't get one. I was kind of hoping that, you know, putting partisan interest to one side, I thought that we weren't far away from that being a day five scrap that we would have spoken about for a very long time.
Yeah, and an England win in this first match would have set this series up beautifully, because suddenly there would have been a lot of pressure back on Australia, whereas now it's a bit more expected to be business as usual. There's some talk about whether England will be more competitive at Adelaide, but aside from that, you know, if they go 2-0 down there, it's pretty well game over.
They were fairly forthright about the fact they knew how hard it was going to be to win here, but I think they were ahead in the test match at the halfway mark, and really that's not for nothing. If you're ahead halfway through a test match, you're going to win more often than not. It was a pretty good comeback from Australia, and we'll come to why that was, namely Steve Smith.
So let's have a look at how that panned out. We were coming into this test match. Usually the Gabba wicket is fairly bouncy, has a bit of pace in it. It's usually not bad for batting on. Well, it's very good for batting on, particularly on the second, third, fourth days. But this wicket was different. There's been a lot of rain around in the month or so before this test match. There's been unseasonally cool weather. Even through the test match, it was mostly in the mid-20s rather than in the 30s, which it would normally be up here. So there hasn't been a lot of sunlight to bake that wicket and make it sort of hard and bouncy. So instead, it was quite moist, sort of like undercooked cake batter. So the pace bowlers could go quickly through the air, but it wasn't going to jump off the wicket. England won the toss, went out and batted on the first day, and they were expecting to have to sort of block through a difficult first hour or so, and then it would get better for batting, but it actually didn't get great for batting as the day went on.
Yeah, I sort of wrote this at Stumps on day one, is that had we been listening to Kevin Mitchell Jr., the curator here, we probably should have known what it was going to be in the way of a slower, more spongy track, if you like. He fairly well, signaled this before about how much moisture there was going to be left in there. So had we been paying more attention rather than getting sort of sucked into the pre-test phony war hype, we would have known that. But it did suit Nathan Lyon. You wouldn't expect an off-spinner to be the most important weapon on day one. And there's been some scrutiny over the line he bowled on day one, but you can't question the accuracy. He was relentless. He turned the ball significantly. And on another day, and Pat Cummins said this, he would have taken a bag. He beat the bat that many times. But he set it up so that Australia did have seam bowlers with plenty in the tank in the last session. And that's where Pat Cummins came in into his own and took a couple of late wickets. And especially the captain, Joe Root, that was a sensational delivery. He said after play, it's the sort of ball you bowl 100 times and nail once. The big in-swinger that's pitching in line and hitting the stumps. You've got to have very tight margins with DRS.
Those were kind of wins for Australia on day one, but there were wins for England in that they're underrated, unknown, unnamed in some cases, players that they brought into the top six. Mark Stoneman, James Vince, David Malan, they all made half centuries. And particularly the way that Stoneman and Vince went about it on day one. Alistair Cook, the veteran, 11,000 test runs, was out early, faced 10 balls and made two. And then that pair put on a partnership of 125 runs between them, which was bigger than any partnership that England had in 2013-14 in its entirety in that series. And suddenly these two newbies, these greenhorns, were defying the Australian attack day one at the Gabba.
Yeah, and Vince batted beautifully, didn't he? He's been known to be classy, especially through the offside, and he was. But what I noticed as the defining characteristic of his innings was that he struck a lot of threes because he was stroking the ball rather than hitting the ball. He wasn't trying to sort of lash it through cover. He was happy to push through that part of the ground and sort of accept that he'd have to run most of his runs rather than get them for boundaries. And I thought that was admirable considering his best stroke is the cover drive. And as for Stoneman, he came into this series as the informed man in the England side. He hadn't failed to make 50 in any of the warm-up innings, and he continued where he left off really in those warm-up games. And he was outstanding, I thought, especially. He looked the part from the get-go, and it's a pretty hard task coming to Australia and opening the batting in an Ashes series in the first test at the Gabba. But he looked cherry ripe. He looked like he was exactly the sort of temperament to succeed in these sort of conditions.
He had a tough patch when Nathan Lyon came on and started bowling to him, was all over him, really, just wasn't comfortable facing the spin, didn't really know what was happening, wasn't able to get forward to the drop of it. And there was what seemed like it could be a really big moment and then maybe wasn't quite as significant in retrospect, but Tim Payne dropped a catch from Nathan Lyon.
Oh, yes.
And he hadn't actually taken a catch yet. So, the wicketkeeper who'd been parachuted into the team and who hadn't kept much in the last couple of years, there was just this feeling of worry that might really throw him off, that might be something that would sort of crush his zest and enjoyment at making a comeback to the test team.
It's funny, I'd forgotten about the Payne drop catch, which sort of says a bit about how quickly events superseded it, but he did put down a chance that did earn him sort of back page headlines after being brought into the side, which would have been really tough. I mean, Brad Haddin was reported to have said that he did everything right to get into position for that catch. The ball just didn't stick. And we know when the keeper is up to the stumps that they do, they stick or they don't. It's hard to make that adjustment at the very last minute, but he wasn't able to do so on that occasion. But again, the Payne decision, I think, did validate itself over the course of the test match. I think that he didn't make many runs, but he looks like he may have at another time. Yeah, that sounds like a bit of a daft thing to say, but he looks like he did have the sort of game that could survive and not be a complete disaster at test level. And with the gloves, with the exception of that drop catch, he was faultless.
So what you're saying is there may be a sliders universe very similar to this one in which Tim Payne did make runs in the test match.
One day, Jeff, we're going to have our sliders podcast. That's not this one.
So the catch goes down. And there's this thought that maybe this is a big moment. Maybe this is something that's going to cost them. Nathan Lyon's the bowler. He's been denied the catch. He's had problems with wicketkeepers before. Vince goes on to 83. And then Nathan Lyon, in the covers, runs across to his right, picks up a ball one-handed on the bounce. Vince is going through for what he thinks is a tight but fairly comfortable single. And Lyon, while travelling in the direction of the throw, somehow kind of, it's a very awkward position. It's easier to throw across your body when you're on the move, but he's having to throw in the direction that he's going, in this kind of chicken wing formation with the arm, gets the throw out, nails two stumps dead on, and runs him out.
Yeah, Temba Bavuma, when he was in this country last year, executed a couple of similar run-outs. And you don't really pair up Bavuma and Nathan Lyon. They're not mentioned in the same sentence very often. I kind of took from that how much work someone like Nathan Lyon probably does put into his fielding in a very professional Australian outfit. I mean, you go back a generation or two and the bowlers did very little fielding at all, but that was a piece of athleticism that did really set up Australia's last hour on night one to, you know, they may not have been at parity, but they were near enough to that when they returned for day two.
So they were 4 for 196 at the end of day one, and they would have been pretty happy with that, battling through on a fairly tough day. The Australian press jumped on them for scoring slowly, and then, of course, pumped up Australia for scoring slowly over the next couple of days. So they were 246 for four, looking good to push on to 350 and beyond, and then the short ball barrage began.
Yeah, it really did set the wheels in motion, didn't it? They nearly saw it out, which from an England perspective, they came such a long way on that second morning. The thing about short bowling is perhaps misunderstood sometimes, is that you can't do it for a long period of time. Three or four overs, maybe five overs tops, and you need to have a blow. You can't keep going. And Stark was into his fourth over of that new spell, where they made a clear adjustment. Before the 90th over of the innings, they had bowled an average about 30% short balls. And then after the 90th over, that clicked up to 74%. So that gives you a sense of how quickly their direction changed. And Stark probably would have been getting to the stage where he would have had to have tried something new. And I guess the all-out bounce award wouldn't have occurred through the afternoon. But instead, Dawid Malan, after batting really nicely for a half century, did get suckered into one too many pull shots. Big fat top edge, taking it backward square leg by Sean Marsh, and that got Australia going. And it also opened the door for Nathan Lyon alongside the work being done by Cummins and Stark. But Lyon at that point bowled his best spell at a test match to that stage. He beat the bat a lot on day one, but on day two he bowled a much straighter line, and we saw that with some excellent bowling. He trapped Moeen Ali with an off break that pitched on leg stump and straightened to the left hander, and then he went through Chris Wokes with an off break that turned about a foot and a half. It was an excellent piece of bowling.
And from there, it was pretty much short balls all the way. Bairstow got out to one. Jake Ball got out to one. Stuart Broad got out to one.
Yeah.
And they were just sort of swinging happily and got a couple of top edges away. There wasn't a thought-through approach. It wasn't that England had said, this is how we're going to take on the short ball. It seemed like they were surprised to be being bowled bouncers, which, when you think about the lead-up to this series and what happened last time, how could it have possibly been? How could they not have worked on better methods to combat short bowling? If you're paying a coach for a strategy that says swing at everything and hope you get a thick top edge, you'd want a refund.
Yeah, look, maybe, but again, I looked at that more about Australia than I did England. I think we talked about it being like a Christmas present. Once they got the batteries for the Christmas present, they couldn't put it down. Once they saw the bouncer worked, they needed to keep going and keep going and keep going, almost like they were proving a point that they could punish the English lower order with penetrative short pitch bowling. And look, maybe that will have a lasting legacy. They're certainly going to continue with it in Adelaide. Mitchell Stark said as much when he fronted the media a couple of nights ago. So either way, no matter how you frame it up, it's going to be that kind of series. But England also did it when they were bowling too, with a far less venomous bowling attack. They tried exactly the same approach. So maybe it will be a series which is determined by who can play and who can bowl the short ball better.
So Australia comes out to bat and they're in real trouble pretty early. And this is the point of the test match where England is well on top. So Cameron Bancroft on debut, nicks off. He's gone for five. David Warner's cramped up on a little sort of pull shot around the corner. He's caught at mid-wicket for 26. Usman Khawaja is trapped leg before wicket by Moeen Ali. Problems he's had against off-spin. Mm. So he's gone for 11. And then Peter Hanscom gets done completely, all ends up LBW by James Anderson, hit on the back pad right in front of the stumps, and he's gone for 14. So at this point, they're 76 for 4 with the newly recalled and often shaky starter Sean Marsh at the crease and Steve Smith at the other end, and England would have thought, we've got him here.
A huge amount of credit to Joe Root and the Brains Trust at England HQ for coming up with some plans that were working from the outset. So David Warner was caught in that way a couple of times in 2015 during the Ashes series. So little wonder there were two catching mid-wickets for him from almost the very first over from memory. Usman Khawaja beaten on the inside edge by Moeen Ali from a ball that didn't spin. Again, that's been a problem for him, especially in Sri Lanka last year when he lost his spot in the Australian side in Asian conditions. He didn't get it back till Bangladesh. He missed all the tests in India as a result of that. But the one I sort of really think about is Peter Hanscom. Now, we know he gets deep in the crease routinely early in his innings. It doesn't happen the whole way through, but certainly early on, he uses the whole depth of the crease. His back foot nearly hits the stumps. He goes back so far as he's finding his way and finding the pace and the pitch and all the rest. And it works for him. No sort of problem with that. But what he wouldn't have had to come up against before is someone like Jimmy Anderson, who can land the ball on the same spot six times in a row and make it do two or three different things. And in the end, it was a couple of back at a length deliveries which set him up. Then the quicker Yorker, wasn't quite a Yorker, it was just a full of length delivery, which did tail back towards the right-hander. And I do wonder whether that'll end up being one of the real strong and solid sort of interesting contests of the Ashes ahead.
So Sean Marsh and Smith battle through to stumps, and I think we've got to pay credit to Sean Marsh. His spot in the side was fairly rightly questioned in terms of the process that led up to his selection. We talked about that last week. As a player, he's quite erratic. He can sort of do everything or nothing. He had one of his everything days. He left the ball really well. Yep. He was disciplined. He didn't have a lot of false shots, and he gradually got going and started to look pretty good when he played a few shots. He got through to stumps and then was out the next morning having made 50, but had provided invaluable support there for Smith because he took the score through from 76 for 4 all the way through to 175 for 5. So
yeah, it was an ugly-looking dismissal because he got caught at mid-off, but it was a good setup. You know, they knew that on morning 3 the ball wasn't going to move as much till they got access to a second new ball, so they bowled a whole series of leg cutters and off cutters at Marsh to make him make the pace. And the first time that Broad gave him one in his area, because obviously Sean Marsh loves the cover drive, the pace was taken off and he misjudged that and miscued accordingly to mid-off. So again, sort of advantage England there for the thinking that went behind the way they went about bowling to the Australian top order, because in the absence of that, Sean Marsh, as you said before, looked really good. He looked bang on for 100 actually, because we've seen before that once Marsh gets a decent start, he's very hard to remove.
Yeah, it gets out a lot under 10, and then, you know, if he makes more than 20 or so, pretty hard to get rid of. So yeah. Broad was bowling really quick and straight at him for a good couple of overs, you know, right at the stumps, full balls with full pace. And after about 15 or so deliveries like that, slipped one just that bit wider, but that's when he took the pace off, the first one he'd taken the pace off in that spell. So
that's right.
From there, it's really on Smith. And you were talking before about England playing the short ball. That's exactly the opposite of what we saw Steve Smith do. So the English batsmen indulged their desires to play certain shots, and Steve Smith was ascetic. You know, he sat in his bare concrete cell on his little straw mattress, and, you know, he chanted and he prayed and he didn't eat and he didn't drink and he didn't speak. And he just put all the shots away and he just waited them out. And waited them out and waited them out until he got the ball that he wanted to play, and he played a shot to that ball and no other ball.
561 minutes he was at the crease through the course of, you know, over 9 hours and 21 minutes, I think it was. Imagine concentrating on anything for that long, like trying to, you know, repeatedly get your mind in the right condition to not make a mistake. It's not as though Steve Smith can't hook. It's not as though Steve Smith can't pull or uppercut or God knows what. He's got every shot in the book, some that don't even have a place in the bookie because he has that unorthodox batting grip.
And he's got shots that he's written on the back of a napkin and then like jammed in the back of the book and stuck them down with tape.
May as well have for that. He's got that much opportunity to score. He knows he can score around the 360, as they more talk about in the women's game, but Smith can. And he made a decision not to. It was a conscious choice that he was not going to allow himself to be exposed. He knew that the pitch wasn't with the pace that he necessarily would like to play those sorts of shots. England, more to the point, set up with initially what they call the Yorkshire Wall, and that's what sits in front of the with three or four players in catching positions in front of the wicket. But they moved them over to having three in the deep in a ring, 20 metres out from the boundary at square leg, deep backward square leg, and fine leg, almost a long leg in the old language. And they were all well in from the boundary. It was almost as though, have a go, mate. See what you can do. Try and take us on. And he just didn't do it. He just refused. It was as though he made a pact with himself that every short ball is going to let sail over his head or get back in the crease and knock on the head. And he did it so well. And after play, I mean, I asked him, is it the best innings he's played in his career? In other words, is it better than the 100 he made in the second innings at Pune back in February? And he sort of broadly agreed with the proposition that it was. And I think the stage was such that that's an easy case to make. The first Ashes test match, which he's captained, you know, in Australia, all the pressure around winning at the Gabba, the parlour situation Australia were in, the way he dug Australia out of that hole and got them a first innings lead makes it one of the all-time modern great innings, and certainly sort of the proverbial captain's knock, if you like.
One observation about Steve Smith. In the previous Ashes series in Australia, over in Perth, he made his second test century. It was really a breakthrough innings for him, the one that proved that, you know, he could do it more than the once, which was in a dead rubber at the Oval. This was in a live series in Perth. Australia were 5 for not many.
Yep.
That 100 was defined by hooking. He hooked all day.
He slapped as well. It was like really aggressive batting. It was like any ball that was short, he was either hooking who is hitting in front of square towards what you consider to be a wide long on. Like, he was leaving no chance to be. Every time they gave him a chance to score, he did exactly that. You bang on.
And I remember writing about that innings at the time, and it was all about the way Smith rotated at the crease, the way he swiveled on his heels. And England on a Perth deck, they had that thing that visiting teams often have where they get a bit sucked in and they just try to bowl too short too often. And he punished them all day, and he made 100 runs from it. To have that player be the same player who's out here in an Ashes contest 4 years later, leading the side, and not play a hook shot at all, it's just an amazing change that shows the versatility and adaptability that he has.
Yeah, 21 test hundreds now in 57 tests. He's averaged 72 since becoming captain. He's captained Australia 27 times for 1,300, so one in every other test match as captain is he's making 100. He's got the second best batting average as a captain behind Don Bradman now, as I mentioned before, at 72. That's just incredible. And he's now made taken across the whole sweep of his career, which remember started very slowly. He's got a century every five innings, which, you know, you rattle those numbers off and you think about where he was 4 years ago, or better still, 7 years ago when he first played Ashes cricket in 10-11. That was unheard of. And we spoke to Steve Smith a couple of weeks ago for Wisden that appeared in The Observer a couple of weeks ago. And in that chat with him, he was talking about just how far he has come across that seven-year Ashes cycle, how ill-equipped he was for the contest back then to now. He's just such a dominant force. You just can't. You could never have seen it being quite like this for him. And now he's irrefutably the best player in the world. I don't think there's any real doubt in that now. I know Kohli's made a double hundred in the last couple of days against Sri Lanka, but it's hard to mount an argument, or a sustainable one anyway, that Steve Smith isn't number one in the world, and that's built by any metric you like.
Well, he's made the runs in all conditions. 300s in four tests in India earlier this year.
Yep.
He's made three in England, he's made them in South Africa, he's made them in the West Indies, he's made them in New Zealand. He's places where he's only played two or three test matches, he's made hundreds.
Sure.
He's made, he's crossed 50 42 times, and he's gone on to 121 of those times.
Incredible conversion rate. I mean, this is, you know, again, you look at the way in which his numbers have added up. You look at his, the one I'm quite fond of is the above 50 rate for Smith, which is something like, again, it's better than one in every two innings. He's getting to a half century, and I know Jeff, you keep a very elaborate spreadsheet with all these numbers, and this is part of your. I can see you looking it up over my shoulder as we speak. You've literally gone into your computer and looking for your spreadsheet. Where you can tell me precisely how often Smith's been above 50. But again, if you just apply it to innings he's played since that breakout 100 at the Oval in 2013, it's even more impressive. Again, he played 11 Test matches before he actually made that breakthrough ton.
42 scores of 50 or more means a ratio of one every 1.36 Test matches, or every 2.5 innings.
That's crazy. It's better than the run that Michael Clarke was on when he had that purple patch through a 30-test period between 2011 and 2013. At the time, we thought that was pretty special, the run of form. This supersedes that, and again, just kind of underscores the sort of special thing we're seeing at the moment, and we should embrace it, whether we're Australian fans or England fans or anything in between. We should embrace it. We're seeing something that we're going to talk about for a very long time, I think.
Can I read you a little piece from a Guardian contributor? Robert Wilson writes in all the time to the OBO.
Please do.
This is a magnificent little bit of analysis, though. It's just a paragraph or two. He said, "I was thinking about Stevie S this morning, and I think I now understand everything. I tried to work out how many shots he had. Some batsmen build a career around two or three. Ponting and Cook spring to mind. Some have every shot going, but one neon-lit giant weakness. Or was it an outsized mental strength? War and Warn step up as temperamentally variant exemplars. Particular dedication, lunatic ambition, global cussedness. He's no Brian Lara, but nor is he a Boycott, a Border, nor a Gavaskar. It didn't take me long to understand that I couldn't work him out at all. And that was when the world became clear to me, and gloriously simple, and beautiful too. I don't think anyone can work him out. That's a pretty sizable trump card."
Gosh, he should have our job, shouldn't he? Robert McLean Wilson, quite a writer. I'm not even going to try and put it any better than that. We could probably put a cap on.
Got to pay some credit as well to Pat Cummins, who was essential with the bat in supporting Steve Smith in that innings, and Smith wouldn't have been able to do what he did without that support. Cummins made 42, faced 120 deliveries, you know, batted out there for hours with the captain and supported him, actually made the bulk of the runs in their partnership of 66.
Yeah, and not the first time he's done this either. In Dhaka back in September. He played a really important hand, very similar to this, actually. He faced over 100 balls there as well, and he just reinforces that he's got the complete game with ball and bat. He bats in the top four for his club side. He bats number six in the Big Bash League, of course, for the Sydney Thunder, and you can't imagine it's long before he'll overtake Mitchell Starc in the Australian Test lineup. Starc's got a fine record with bat in hand as well, but Cummins looks a far more complete player, and he just is clearly making it count after such a long time out of international cricket with those string of debilitating injuries. He's taking every opportunity to influence games with ball or with bat.
They get bowled out for 328. They take a small lead, 26 runs into the second innings, and England come out. And you'd think even then it's still advantage England. They can build up to a lead, and as long as they get more than a couple of hundred ahead, it should be fairly testing for Australia.
Yeah, the Josh Hazlewood factor, really, wasn't it? Because Hazlewood had a poor first innings, and I wouldn't say there's pressure on him. That'd be a daft thing to say, given how well Josh Hazlewood's bowled for Australia. But it was quite noticeable that it was Starc and Cummins, then Hazlewood. And I don't know whether we necessarily expected that coming in. Maybe it was a bit of a hangover from that injury that he acquired in Bangladesh earlier in the spring. Hard to say. But even so, he came out, picked up the first couple. But the one of note was Alistair Cook, who was caught down at deep fine leg. There were some observations in the press box and in the commentary that maybe it was the shot of a player coming towards the end of his career, lacking the concentration to get through to stumps. I'm not so sure about that. I've seen Cook play quite a bit in 2017, including a 243 he made against the West Indies at Edgbaston in the middle of the English summer, and he's still got plenty to offer at the top level, but it still put England in a very difficult position overnight after doing so well in the first half of the day to take consistent wickets. They were the ones on the back foot leading into day four.
Yeah, it was maybe just the symbolism of that shot. It was Alistair Cook hooking at Adelaide in 2013.
Dead right.
Off Johnson being caught at deep fine leg in the second innings. He'd been bowled by a beauty in the first, and in the second he seemed just a bit desperate, and he took on the short ball without really any sort of plan. He just hooked wildly at it. He was caught in the deep there, and that seemed to be a symbol that England was gone at that point, that they weren't going to be able to fight anything out. I suppose that's maybe why, maybe it's too much significance that we're putting on that dismissal, but when you see the same looking dismissal, the same lack of control in the shot, caught in the same place, the same way, it's just a little bit too similar for comfort.
Yeah, and what it also did, it opened up a crazy old last hour or so. The bowling was as quick as we saw at any stage during a test match with the brand new Kookaburra ball. The pitch had clearly sped up a bit by that stage. It was harder. You talked about it not being baked earlier. It was certainly fully baked by now, clam baked by now, and they were getting some serious speed, the two Australian quicks towards Stoneman. He got hit several times. Joe Root got hit in the helmet, flush from a bouncer. That was a brief moment where I think all of us sort of stopped still, and I think the players especially, they were very keen to make sure he was okay, and thankfully he was. There was no concussion, even though there was a big fat piece of the helmet fell off. It all looked quite brutal, but it was very exciting cricket on Saturday afternoon, and the Brisbane crowd responded accordingly. They had a real treat on Saturday. It was the pick of the test match in terms of the cricket that we saw, and I think one way of measuring that was by fact that there was no fights like there was on day two when people were a bit bored perhaps. It wasn't like it was a year before where people were sculling beers out of their shoes in front of us here in the press box. They were absorbed. They were watching every single ball of action, whether it was when Smith was batting or when the Australian quicks were bowling.
I can't imagine anything worse than drinking out of a shoe.
It's a thing.
You talk about being absorbed. Imagine how much of the beer just gets soaked up into like the sole of the shoe.
I remember sitting in front of here, and it's not, you know, it's quite common at the Gabba for people to having to scull their beers when they walk in from the bar. But this reached new levels last year in that day-night test match. People were being forced to take off their footwear, pour their beer in there, then scull it.
Yeah, maybe an argument for the glass slipper in that case. Cinderella style, if you want a slightly more hygienic imbibing environment.
Barely.
Just a little wedge of lime on the side of the sneaker, you know? Like a little cracked pepper with your drink in a shoe, sir. In terms of this match, we like to look for symmetry, but there's an irresistible bit of symmetry here. Australia were 76 for four. Steve Smith plays the innings of his life. Okay, as discussed. England in the second innings, 74 for four. Joe Root's at the crease when that fourth wicket goes down. And he makes 50 and then gets out the next ball.
Yeah, and he looked ripe, didn't he? He looked good, Root, especially on that fourth morning. He played a couple of lovely cover drives, and it just sort of had the feeling that we were going to see both captains do something special in the opening rubber. Second time in the test match, he was caught leg before from a ball coming back towards his pads. In the last 2 years, Joe Root averages 15 from balls hitting his stumps. Crickviz did that stat for me. Before that, He averaged over 100. So if there is a chink in the Joe Root armour, that's where it is for Australia. So maybe they've done their homework as well.
A couple of bits where it kept going back and forth. England looked like they were putting together a partnership and they'd be able to set a lead and then a wicket would go. There was Moeen Ali first with that fairly controversial stumping where the third umpire replay was pretty inconclusive, but they gave him out anyway.
Since when did we have the third umpire making an on-balance call in favour of the dismissal? I thought maybe I'm blinkered by virtue of the fact that I wanted to see a close result, but how could you have an effusive view on that? It is so inconclusive. I mean, I would have thought in that scenario, by default, it has to be given not out. That's how I read it anyway.
Tim Payne spoke afterwards and he said, you know, it was a very sharp bit of work from him, we should say.
You know, absolutely.
And a good piece of keeping to come back from that drop catch earlier. And he said he was very confident that he could see a bit of paint behind the foot. And there probably was, you know, in reality, close up, there probably was. But on any of the replays, that wasn't necessarily supported. And it seemed like there was enough doubt there that he should have been reprieved.
Yeah, and it was at a crucial moment as well. So Moeen went. We already talked about the way that Johnny Bairstow capitulated. At different stages through that day, even though Australia were taking consistent wickets, they were ticking the board over at a far greater rate than they were in the first innings. The sense I had at the time was we weren't far away from them getting above, say, a 200 lead or 230, like we mentioned before at the start of the podcast, and that was undone by Johnny Bairstow.
And late in the piece, it was the short ball that did it. It was Mitchell Starc. Now, last year against Pakistan here, he bowled a brilliant short ball with a very old ball. I think it was 69 overs old, yep, maybe at that point. They were on nearly 450 at the time, and Asad Shafiq got a nasty short ball up at him, came off the shoulder of the bat, was caught in the gully. Chris Wokes got a very similar one from Mitchell Starc with a ball that was, again, about 60-odd overs old. Soft ball, but he still got it to lift, got it to leap, and had Chris Wokes caught by Steve Smith at slip this time.
And then at the end, they took those 3 for 1. The fast bowlers promised to clean off the tail. That's precisely what they did, and Australia only had 170 to go to claim the victory. I thought for a while there we were on track for a four-day test. It was the sense I was getting when the Australian batsmen went out to the middle is that they weren't going to leave anything to chance. Not that it was likely to rain in Brisbane on day 5, but they were batting with serious purpose. They had the extra half hour available to them, and Bancroft, he looked a dream last night. That lofted stroke he played off Moeen was one of real purpose, using his feet. There was an on drive down the ground not long before stumps, which is perhaps the best shot of the entire test match. And they went to stumps, only requiring 56 on the final day. Job done.
And I don't know if this was a team direction, but it seemed like David Warner was very happy to take it into the final day and then to give Cameron Bancroft a lot of time to bat. And I think that might have been a tactical consideration to say Bancroft was out early in the first innings on debut, hasn't batted much, will be important over the course of the series, and that it was well worth it for Australia to get him an extended stint in the middle. And that's what they did, because by the time the runs were knocked off quite slowly on day 5, he'd faced 182 balls. He was 82 not out. He'd hit the winning boundary in an Ashes test, and he must be full of confidence going forward, whereas if Warner had knocked the runs off last night, that might not have been the case.
I think you described it in print today, Jeff, as a very good net session they had this morning, and it means they're cherry ripe again to take it up again in Adelaide next week against a bowling attack which will be far better suited to the Adelaide conditions than they were Brisbane.
Yeah, well, this week, in fact, not actually far to go, given that the day 5 is a Monday, and we'll be back in action at the Adelaide Oval on Saturday.
Gee, it comes quick, doesn't it, these back-to-back test matches? It feels like back in the old days, maybe we got a bit more of a breather, but we're straight back in, aren't we?
And a massive event that will be. Day-night Ashes test, the first one of those. You'd expect a huge crowd at Adelaide, particularly night one, the Saturday night down for that test match.
They're such a great event, aren't they, the day-night tests at Adelaide? I mean, there's something about being at the back of the members after dark. They lap it up. It's their Melbourne Cup day every day, the Adelaide test match, and the day-night element has just kind of added to that, and they've got very healthy crowds in year one and year two for test matches that haven't involved England. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw sellouts for at least the first couple of days, but maybe all four, or if, you know, the 4 days they sell tickets for before the start of a match, because it's going to be that big an event. It's going to be huge.
We'll be back with you to preview that Adelaide test, and we'll be back with you all through the summer with the final word.
Make sure you subscribe in all the usual places and places we probably haven't thought of yet. Bug it into Google. You'll find somewhere there, iTunes and SoundCloud and Audio Boom, and there are a raft of places you can continue to hear us through the summer, and we hope we do have your company then.
This has been The Final Word, presenting The Guardian's Ashes podcast. We'll see you next time. My future question, my current senses, that'd be the same we've been doing for centuries. Sorry if I ran out to empty. Wrote this so you know what I meant here. I had to go about